During the question and answer session at the panel on Coltan and the crisis in the Congo this past weekend, one audience member asked about the difference between the genocide in Darfur and the conflict in the Congo. Here's the response from the panelists.
There's one key distinction between what's happening in Darfur or what has been happening in Darfur and Congo, because you're right about the death toll. Congo, way more people have died in the conflict. Darfur is a genocide. Which means, as I was talking about earlier, when you look at the definition of genocide, all those things are happening in Congo. The difference is that there's a systematic effort to wipe out an entire race of people in Darfur. And I think humanity always has to view that in a unique way. So I don't think that Darfur deserves less attention, but I certainly think Congo deserves a lot more attention. What you hear in D.C. in policy circles is that people are trying to move away from getting too tripped up on whether or not something is a textbook genocide, because there's a lot of international legal issues that come with that, whether or not something is or isn't a genocide. So in Darfur, basically, you have people who've been so busy patting themselves on the back for calling it a genocide that they haven't actually done anything. So what people tend to look at now is something called responsibility to protect, R2P, which is the basic notion that it is a government's responsibility to protect its own citizens from mass atrocity. When a government fails to do so, it is the international community's responsibility to step in. And when we talk about the genocide movement, what we see happening now with Darfur is it certainly has absolutely galvanized this huge population of people in this movement. Now we want to turn that into a lasting movement that will extend to mass atrocities, which is Congo. So Congo is now being looked at more as the poster child for what's been ignored because it's not a genocide. And you see a lot of those same celebrities, a lot of those organizations starting to reach out to their constituencies around Congo, which is good news.
Again, you're listening to a panel on Coltan, cell phones, and the crisis in the Congo. The music you're hearing is Vusi Mahlasela from South Africa. The audience members who were asking questions, one asked whether there has been pushback for those who have tried to get the story out in the media. And here's the panelists' response.
There has been a pushback against getting the story out. There absolutely has. I've talked with the journalists who worked for the AP International out of London, who told me about the very direct discussions that they had refusing to cover Congo because they believed that people, that we don't have... The reason was we don't have room in our consciousness for more than one international news story.
And as I said earlier, I was disappointed that Josh and I had to write this article and that it wasn't true investigative journalists. You know, we have an environmental scientist and a poet writing about an important international issue because nobody else was doing it. And you need to take something away with you here, we do have extra copies of Issue 25 that feature... the article and the initial interview with Lisa.
If I can jump in really quickly, it's interesting that you should mention the Holocaust, because as I pointed out earlier, there's some of the same players. Cabot, a subsidiary of Bayer. Bayer was very cooperative with the Nazis. Cabot, American company, very cooperative with the Nazis. The Bush family, the evil Bush family. This is the good Bush family represented here. The evil Bush family, you know, kind of behind the scenes, very cooperative with the Nazis. In a lot of ways, it's the same players. And they have one goal, and that is money and the power that money represents. And it has nothing to do with human dignity or human rights. That's not an interest of theirs. It just kind of gets in the way. And I think any story, Darfur or otherwise, that gets Africa attention is a good thing, because all of Africa is having trouble. The legacy of colonialism is there. The economic colonialism that's been going on for since the end of World War II, that's still happening. And it's not going to go away unless enough people stand up. I mean, we have tribal structures that were broken down very intentionally. You know, the wise women and wise men were killed or driven out of their practice, keeping this kind of violence and conflict in check. And, you know, kids dying in the jungle shouldn't happen, because there should be medicine people that can take advantage of the jungle to treat their people, but they were all destroyed, or most of them. And that's, there needs to, in addition to stopping the violence, there needs to be a real concerted effort to rebuild things socially, and the Run for the Congo work and things like that go to that creating and building side of it. That's very important.
I just want to add one thing, which is that I was that girl 4 years ago, running up and down the halls of D.C., talking with every organization that's supposed to be dealing with genocide, asking them why they weren't dealing with Congo too. So I've been fighting this battle for like 4.5 years, trying to get those guys, like the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum, why won't they do something for Congo? And they did start talking about Congo, and they did host a conference. You know, I mean, letting those organizations know that we also want them to be talking about Congo is really important. Now I'm at a moment where I feel a little grateful, because they are starting to do that. So for me, it feels like a victory that the movement is building that way, and Congo is getting more coverage. But that's because I've been a major player in that fight for 4 years, and spent a couple years basically having doors slammed in my face, like, we don't have time to talk to you, you know. So I'm feeling your frustration.
Well, unfortunately, we didn't have these YouTube videos that we could show, but the Tantalum exists in alluvial areas that are from ancient mountains that have been basically eroded down, and it's not too far below the ground. A lot of the mining that you see in the pictures on YouTube is like they're going into little ant hills. Sometimes it might be 100 feet down, but a lot of times it's only 20 feet down. Sometimes they just take water and destroy the hillside and get right to it that way. The problem is, one of the ecological problems is that it exists in national parks in the Congo.
That's right.
And so the groups that are up there doing the mining, even though they don't get paid, they do have to get fed, and they're often fed with bush meat, another use of that word, the bush. And that means gorillas sometimes, and other exotic species. So that's one of the things that we talk about in our article.
Yeah. To be blunt, it's hillsides destroyed, rivers turned to mud, animals of all kinds slaughtered. In some parts of this national park, whose name I forget, unfortunately, you can't find an antelope or a chimpanzee. The lowland gorillas, which are the most endangered species of gorilla, are being slaughtered and on heading for extinction. No one can find a forest elephant in the area. The hippopotamus herds have gone from thousands down to a few hundred. And that's not counting all the smaller animals, all the trees being chopped down for firewood and for building materials. And this isn't just mining camps that are doing this. A lot of it is displaced people who, like I said before, they just want food and shelter. And that's why even if your primary concern is the environment, even if you're a total misanthrope, which I have to admit to a little bit of that tendency myself, if you care about the environment, if you care about the other non-human species we share our planet with, you have to care about human rights, because people who are in a bad way aren't thinking about the environment. They're running in survival mode. And survival mode is, I will do what it takes to get food. I will do what it takes to be warm. And you're not thinking about if this is the last couple gorillas. You're thinking, hey, that animal's made out of meat, and I like meat when I'm hungry.
There's a critical point that I think hasn't been brought up when we're talking about environment in Congo, which is that Congo holds the second biggest tract of continuous tropical forest in the world. It holds 8% of the world's carbon stores. You cannot deal with global warming without addressing environmental issues in Congo. Greenpeace and The Guardian ran amazing articles a couple of years ago about the way that the government of Congo basically has signed off logging rights to huge tracts of Congo, which would open up that forest to be decimated within like a number of years. Incredible article called Sold Down the River. There's a link to it on my website, 1000sisters.com. If you want to check it out, just go to the resources. It's at the bottom of the list. Amazing article. I mean, they were going into communities, forest-dwelling communities, and negotiating with these communities with shady contracts, kind of like very colonial, very much like along the lines of King Leopold's Ghost. They were negotiating for rights to log for like bags of sugar. Huge tracts of forest that were worth millions of dollars, you know, for the price of like what one tree was worth. And the people didn't understand. They put all this pressure on like these pygmies who were just trying to figure it out. So it's essential that we preserve Congo's forest. There was some progress made at that time, but the environment. I mean, the Congo forest basin is you know the world's resource. We have to protect it. I will say as well, I think one thing that hasn't come up is that I wrote a whole chapter in my book on environment in Congo, and I wrote it specifically around this amazing man, Dominique, who is a Congolese conservationist. He grew up in a little village that's on the cusp of Kahuzi-Biega Park, and you know, when he was like 20, he started this little environmental nonprofit and got people who were poachers to start carving animals to sell to tourists and that kind of thing. That was 1993. And then the genocide happened in 1994 in Rwanda. All the tourists were routed through there, so tourism stopped. Then there was a flood of Hutu refugees that came over the border, set up refugee camps all around the park. They were there for a year and a half until Rwanda invaded to wipe those refugees out. And when they did, those refugees went into the forest. So now you have Interahamwe, that militia, in the forest, and they totally rule it. They're the ones doing the coltan mining, and he's actually been there and seen the sites, and I write about that in my book. But the thing about Dominique is here you have this guy, all he wants to do is go and like create these little community projects to keep his community and like pygmies who have been displaced and women who are widows of park guards who have been killed by trying to protect the forest. You know, he's trying to do this work, and like 3 weeks ago, a militia broke into his house and shot his mom. So when we talk about this interface between communities who want to do good things for the environment, I mean, Dominique's so cute. It's like you go to his office and he has murals of gorillas, and all the gorillas who have been poached or killed, he keeps pictures of them with their names, kind of like his pet dogs. You know, I mean, he really, really loves those animals and just wants to.
You're listening to Coltan and the Crisis in the Congo. This was a panel that was held this past weekend at the E-Convergence, and we're playing it here on KBOO, your community radio station.
Fuga mzi wa nzundu, wasilile lumu.